Well, welcome to Aggieland.
It's great to be here.
I wanted to start first by asking about, you know, if there are some young people in the crowd that really did hear that call to serve, what are the steps they should take in order to join the State Department and make a difference in the world?
So, team standing right in the back on your way out, so we'll sign you up. So there's lots of different ways to serve at the State Department. We have folks from all different backgrounds, engineers, event planners, speech writing teams, all the skills that the Lord gives different people. You can go take a look at, on our website. And then for those who want to make a career working in the Foreign Service, it's to study hard and prepare for the Foreign Service exam. And then the process is pretty straightforward from there.
Okay, great. As we sort of look towards the future, what does how does the State Department meet the technological challenges that the 21st century presents?
So there's two things as we look forward that I think are absolutely paramount. As Jerrica said, I'm now two weeks short of being Secretary of State for one full year. There's two things as I stare at the State Department to make sure that we're ready for the 21st century. One of them is what you identified. We need the capacity to move at the speed of our adversaries. They move quickly, whether that's Al-Qaeda or ISIS or the Russians or the Cubans. They make decisions quickly. None of those are democracy with all the process that's attached to that. And I wouldn't trade it for a world. Don't confuse. But we have to make sure that American diplomacy can move at that speed. There's an information component to that. There's a technology component to that. And there's places that we have real work to do. The second thing we need, and by the way, that space, that information management space, we saw this with the Russian efforts to impact our elections. We see this in the information space in Iran today. That information space is an incredibly important component of being able to deliver the American message around the world in ways that it wasn't 20 or 30 years ago. The capacity for cheap, simple information readily available on your handset is different and presents a different information challenge for us. And we need to make sure that we're sitting there right on people's handset, sharing the American message in the same way that our adversaries want to share in those countries as well. The second piece is cultural inside an institution. I have run a tank platoon. I was an executive officer in a cavalry troop. I ran two small businesses, then was the director of the CIA, and now I'm running the State Department. Every organization has to have an ethos, a central mission set that is clearly understood so that every single officer of the State Department understands the commander's intent. And so we're working to build out life cycle training programs and making sure that that the ethos of the 21st century diplomat, the commitments that I spoke about in my remarks, are at the forefront of every officer's mind. So when you get to a place and you get to a time when there's a decision to be made, and perhaps the guidance isn't detailed sufficiently, you'll have the principles, you'll have the core understanding of what it is the expectations are for American diplomats, and you'll make a really good decision. I'm confident that we're in a good place there, but there's always more that can be done.
Great. Our campus is so excited to welcome you here today. And in the lead up to today, we gave the community the opportunity to submit some questions, and Wiley has gathered some of those great submissions, and so now I'd like to turn to our audience for some more questions. Can you please stand?
Howdy.
Hi. Howdy. I get it right. Yeah.
Good job.
I'm from Kansas. I got it all going. I figured out.
So my name is Riley Farrell. I'm a sophomore here. And I have a question for you. Here at Texas A&M, we have a very strong tie to the military, which is very similar to your alum, West Point. How has this exposure to military culture when you were younger shaped your perceptions of diplomacy?
Yeah, that is a fantastic question. You do have that same culture here, for sure. Throughout the whole institution, the commitment to duty and service permeates this institution in the same way it did the place that I did my undergraduate time. I will tell you the other thing that I really took away from my time as a young officer in the military that I think is of enormous value in my current role, and I ask all of our diplomats to do this, which is to listen. I remember, I've told this story before, there's an E7 named Sergeant First Class Petrie, When I was a young second lieutenant, I went to my first assignment. I got out of what was an M151 Jeep. Very few of you would remember these. And I climbed out, and I walked over to him, and I had my gold bar, and I'd been commissioned for all of, I don't know, 90 days or 120 days. And I walked up to Sergeant Petrie, and he saluted and said, young man, you'll do well if you just shut up for a while. He was right. I was also afraid of him, so it all worked. The capacity to understand, the capacity to listen in the military is critical. To listen to your soldiers, to make sure you understand, to listen to your commander so you understand exactly what it is they're trying to get at. The same thing is here. I spend a great deal of my time talking, engaged with my counterparts around the world. I was with Chilean President Piñera a few days back, right? I wanted to not only hear him, to hear what he'd said, the things he had in his mind, but to listen in a way to try and comprehend what it was he really wanted and how our two countries could work best together. If he said, what's the one thing that I remember from my time in service? I learned a lot about leadership, but one of the things I truly did come to appreciate was the value of listening and taking on board the ideas of others so that you can execute the mission more effectively. I hope all of the folks who work here at the State Department take that lesson on board as well. Thank you,
Riley. Thank you so much for your answer and for joining us here in Ivyland.
Thank you. Thank you, Riley.
Hi, Mr. Secretary. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Yanira Garcia. I'm a third-year PhD student. My question to you is, how does the State Department handle time-sensitive issues such as the humanitarian crisis currently gripping Venezuela? Thank you.
So you have a big government. That means sometimes we don't move just as fast as we need to. The great news is when a crisis breaks, we're good. We're very effective. So we have a group that is called the USAID. They provide aid and assistance, usually medicine and food. And literally, within a handful of days of the recognition that the crisis, the humanitarian element of the crisis in Venezuela, had spiraled, it had spiked, it had been difficult. This has been years in the making. But it had taken a step change in the wrong direction. We were able to move not only food and medicine, but water. We were able to mobilize airlift from our military, C-17s flying to, I flew in here from Cucuta, Colombia, to take it to the border. The American people are enormously generous, still sitting. I walked through the warehouse where there's still food and medicine sitting. We can't always get it, as in the case of Venezuela. We weren't able to get it to the people who needed it. Maduro is still denying food to the starving and medicine to sick children. I saw some of those sick children yesterday who had crossed the border into Colombia. It's truly tragic. But you should know the State Department in a crisis, and that those crises can range from humanitarian crisis to, I recall very early in President Trump's term, I was not in this job. I was the director of the CIA at the time. When Bashar Assad had used chemical weapons against his own people, your government was able to, in the course of a very eventful 36 hours, do all the groundwork that was needed to make sure that we could respond, to let them, the leader there in Syria, understand that this was unacceptable and this administration wasn't going to allow the use of chemical weapons, Assad to use chemical weapons against his own people. We moved quickly. We moved accurately. The Department of Defense did its task flawlessly. It was a demonstration of American capacity to move in crisis moments in a way that is very effective.
Mr. Secretary, thank you for being here today. I am a dreamer. What would you tell the dreamers in this country who have love for this country, who attended these universities like I have, mm-hmm. and who fear this administration?
Yeah. So,
and thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, sir. Look, this administration has been clear. There was work that was done early on. The administration tried to achieve comprehensive immigration reform, which would have impacted many. I don't know your particular situation, but would have impacted many. Couldn't make the political machine work. It is also the case that President Trump is determined. He is determined to ensure that there's American sovereignty on our southern border and that we know who's coming in and out of our country. That seems like there seems to be widespread agreement. I served in Congress for 6 years, so I suppose you could say I'm part of the problem too. But suffice it to say, I think there's consensus there, and yet we can't get our laws tweaked in a way that I think would fundamentally recognize the central values of America in a way that would do honor to all those who want to come here and want to come here in a way that is lawful, and those that are trying to come here illegal, which is something President Trump has made clear. And I think there's a consensus on both sides of the aisle, frankly, that's something that we need to be capable of stopping as well.
So.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for your service. I can't comment. I don't know your particular case, so I apologize. I can't answer your question about that particular situation.
If we could please hold questions to those with the mic, please.
Mr. Secretary, with the new designation of Iran's Revolutionary Guard as a foreign terrorist organization, I was wondering how heavily the United States would be pursuing sanctions against companies with alleged dealings with this organization.
Vigorously. So we never talk about sanctions, any particular sanction, before we get to the place where we can make a decision. But this was... If you back up a step, it's you have to back up a step. Our mission is to try and create peace and stability in the Middle East. That's the macro objective. And so we've worked on that by building out an enormous coalition to defeat ISIS. We're still working to take down the remnants of ISIS. There are various estimates from 5 to 12 to 21,000 members of ISIS who are still there, moving around in Iraq and Syria and Turkey. Our efforts to continue to prevent them from attacking around the globe are real and serious, and will continue. The second piece of that has been to identify the other great threat, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran, which remains the largest sponsor of terror, who has supported Lebanese Hezbollah, has supported Hezbollah's actions in Syria, the Shia militias under the stranglehold of the Ayatollah who are working in Iraq aren't working for the best interests of the Iraqi people. You see what's happened in Yemen, an enormous humanitarian crisis. The UN did good work in Stockholm to reach an agreement, but the Iranians won't let the Houthis actually implement the Stockholm agreement. So the second piece of this is to convince Iran it's not in their best interest to continue to foment terror and engage in malign activity all throughout the Middle East. So the next step down from that is, how do you do it? One of the pieces of that is our sanctions effort. We have lots of efforts apart from that. With respect to the designation, which actually came into effect just this week, some 20% of the Iraqi economy is controlled by the IRGC. So my wisdom for those of you who are connected to companies that might be doing business with them, or if you're the general counsel for a European bank that's doing business with a company that might have a 20% shareholder to the IRGC, is you should check your work.
Howdy, Mr. Secretary. My question for you is, given your experience as the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, can you elaborate on the intersection between U.S. intelligence operations and U.S. diplomatic operations, as well as how the two cooperate or clash?
Yes, ma'am, I can. Howdy to you. So it's amazing. I'm the only person ever in American history to hold both of those jobs consecutively. We'll find out if that's a good idea or a bad idea. The history books will get to write that. It was fascinating. It was great preparation because I had a couple of advantages coming into this job. I had had a chance to work on almost every one of these same problem sets from a different optic in this administration. So it gave me a good jump start when I came to be Secretary of State. The two institutions have very different mission sets. The CIA's mission set is clean and simple. Deliver the best data set to the most important leader in the world and deliver it in a timely fashion and a consumable fashion. So as CIA director, you spend every moment worried that you didn't get the President of the United States or the Secretary of State or the Secretary of Defense the information they needed to make a really world-class decision in a tough space. So that's the CIA mission. It doesn't come into conflict with the Department of State all that often. Indeed, I spoke with Director Haspel just this morning. Had a handful of questions about a particular problem set I was working on. I asked her to go make sure that tomorrow when I have the opportunity, I get a chance to see their latest and best information set. So they will be providing a tool for us. Done well, the intelligence community, more broadly than just the CIA, there are many other elements. We have folks that do lots of other pieces of intelligence collection. The intelligence community will provide that fundamental underpinning. I talked about the Syria chemical strike. The first in the barrel to respond to that was the CIA. The president wanted to know immediately, were they really chemical weapons that were fired, or was this, right? We all seen YouTube videos that turned out not to be true. Were the chemical weapons actually fired by the regime? Did they actually hit civilians? What was the magnitude? What was the scope? What was the nature of those chemical weapons systems? Before he could make a decision or even consider a recommendation by his Secretary of State about how to respond, he needed to have best-in-class data. And we were under the gun. The CIA, the intelligence community, doesn't get things right every time. As a history, it's made mistakes. It's imperfect like the rest of us. So we were under the gun. The president gave us just a handful of hours. And we deployed an amazing team, and a team of chemists and physicists and engineers and battlefield experts and explosive device experts and folks who spend their whole life looking at potholes in the road to decide what it was that actually created that crater. It's a great life. It took us a few more hours than I wished, but in a matter of hours, I was able to deliver a very clear response to the president, identify places there were risks, what we knew, what we didn't know, but it gave him sufficient information that he could then move on to look for the then Secretary of State to give him a recommendation about the foreign policy that we ought to pursue there. And then in this case, he turned to the Department of Defense to consider potential responses as well. It was a place where you see a perfect example of America's military and diplomacy and intelligence all working together to deliver to the President of the United States a clean set of options based on real data.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, ma'am.
Howdy, Mr. Secretary.
Howdy.
My name is Sanjay Lechiman, and I was wondering, in the light of recent diplomatic efforts abroad with nations such as North Korea and Syria, which you talked about a little bit, do you see sanctions being lifted off these nations in the foreseeable future?
Sanjay, I hope so. I would love nothing more than to lift the sanctions on North Korea. I truly would, because it would mean we were successful. It would mean that North Korea no longer had a nuclear weapons program or a weapons of mass destruction program. It would mean we'd had the opportunity to verify that that was the case, so we knew we weren't taking anyone's word for that. It would be a glorious thing. President Trump talks frequently and tweets almost as often about a brighter future for North Korea, right? We desperately want that. Steve Biegun, I mean, the work that he's done and our team has done, it's remarkable. We have the toughest sanctions in history on North Korea today. And frankly, the work that's been done at the United Nations, they're not American sanctions. These are UN Security Council resolutions. These are the world's sanctions on North Korea. They're the toughest in history. And yet we have also made more progress on negotiating the leader of North Korea to make a strategic shift to make this decision that says, no, it's the history which said that a nuclear weapon system is the only defense, it's our only lever for security, to make the shift to say, no, that's actually what threatens our nation the most. We haven't gotten there. Chairman Kim signed a document in Singapore in June. He's told me no fewer than half a dozen times that he's prepared to denuclearize. I've now spent more time with Chairman Kim than Dennis Rodman. I'm very proud of that. we're not home yet, but I pray that one day that President Trump gets to announce that we're removing the sanctions regime from North Korea. Syria, I'd put Syria in the same bucket. You know, there are those who think that Assad has prevailed. I don't know that there's a need to declare winners and losers, but the facts on the ground are that today Assad rules over a very broken country with 6 million displaced persons. He controls, depending on how you count it, a third to 40% of the real estate of Syria, much of the oil wealth, the thing that has driven Syria's economy for an awfully long time, is not in the control of the Assad regime. And he faces a determined coalition put together in part by the institution that I'm so privileged to run, whether they are European countries or Gulf state nations, or countries even in Africa who recognize that we can't begin to rebuild Syria until there's a political resolution there. And so before those sanctions go away, before not only the UN sanctions, but the American sanctions, the sanctions that the European Union has put in place go away, UN Security Council Resolution 2254 will have to have been fulfilled, which means a political resolution to the outcome. So the migrants who have left Syria for Turkey and for Lebanon and for Jordan can return home, and a political process can be meant to move forward. These sanctions are never something we do with glee, and we do them only as a means to try and achieve an outcome that's good for the United States and good for the world.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sanjay.
Mr. Secretary, yes, my name is Oren Shedd, and I'm a freshman at A&M, and it's an honor to have you here. My question is, what are some important parts of the State Department's work that many people are unaware of?
I talked about the economic work we do. You cannot have an effective national security policy without an economy that is growing. We should all be mindful that America remains $22 trillion in debt. That is a challenge. For those of you who are, my son's 28 years old. You know, I figure we'll pay the bills while I'm here. I wonder if we will for his whole life. You have to have an economy that is thriving and flourishing, and the State Department takes this mission on. There's no other American institution that has officers in the field at nearly every American embassy, 180-plus American embassies, where we have economic officers who, for those of you who go decide to start your own business or run a company or become part of a global operation, touch base with our team. We are unabashed in the Trump administration about making sure that American businesses get every opportunity to go compete. You know, I talked about the aid distribution that we do. I don't think people often connect up the State Department with the humanitarian assistance work that we do. Not only the money, but the work that we do to coordinate. It is almost always the case that when you see a catastrophe like you saw in Mozambique now a few weeks ago, it is almost always the case that it is a State Department officer from the United States that are among the first people that the governor of that country turns to begin to coordinate and develop effective responses. We're incredibly proud of that work. The last thing that I didn't get a chance to talk about that we do is we run big programs that are cultural exchange programs. You would have students here at Texas A&M who came in from other parts of the world to come and study and be part of America. We also work to make sure that students here in America get a chance to go study in other nations. It is remarkable how often I'll be meeting with a foreign leader and I find that his English is better than mine. That is often because of a State Department program that gave them the opportunity to come visit, understand the United States of America, and the dividends that that pays to our nation from having invested those resources are really important. So there's a couple, three thoughts about things the State Department does that don't make the front page of the local paper.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
Howdy, Mr. Secretary.
Could you please share more with us about how you see the relationship between the United States and Latin America developing in the areas of trade and immigration?
So our administration is an enormous beneficiary of the changes that have taken place in South America. For those of you who know the history in South America, democracies have been too few, and free market economies have been far too scarce. Today, South America is turning back in the right direction. You see that in Peru. You see that in Chile. You see that in Brazil. You see it in Ecuador. You see it in many, many South American countries where people have recognized that the old model, call it, I don't want to use a pejorative, but these weren't free market economies, but that the old model had failed them and that they need to rejoin the global world and compete and produce product and add value. And so on trade, I think there's an enormous opportunity for American businesses to go to these places, to go to South American countries and sell our products. There's growing middle classes in these countries as well. And they will also continue to deliver product into our country. So they will continue to move up the value chain and deliver goods for American consumers at prices that are affordable. I think that trade opportunity down there is enormous. When those countries be successful, the migration issues become mitigated, right? People want to stay in their own countries. When I was on the, it's been maybe 36 hours now, I was on the bridge between Colombia and Venezuela. I watched hundreds of people streaming into Colombia. This was on Palm Sunday afternoon. Hundreds of people streaming in there. And I had a chance to talk with a couple of dozen of them. With one exception, they all wanted to return home to their own country. They had family there. They had deep roots there. But they had nothing. There was no economic opportunity for them. Indeed, many of them said that they had stayed in Venezuela longer than they probably should have. I met two mothers who had begun to feed their children every other day. That's breathtaking, absolutely breathtaking. So the solution to that, there's now 1.5 million migrants in Colombia, there are 750,000 migrants in Peru from Venezuela, hundreds of thousands strewn in other countries in South America. The solution to that is creating democracy and opportunity inside of Venezuela. That's the answer to the migration problem, which is burdening Peru and Colombia and Chile and now Ecuador. The solution to that is creating economic opportunity at home so these people can stay in the first instance. Now some 3 million of a population of roughly 30 million, 10% of the people of Venezuela have been forced to flee their country. We need to do two things. First, we need to fix that, allow the Venezuelan people to fix that so that the next 10% don't leave. That's the estimate for 2019. Somewhere between another 2 and 3 million people will have to flee Venezuela because of economic hardship. And then if we do it well and are good enough to do it quickly and begin to rebuild Venezuela, we can get some of the 3 million who have left back home to their families, back home to their homes, back home to what they know and love so that they can be part of the rebuilding of Venezuela. I see those same opportunities with respect to migration issues all throughout South America and Mexico too.
All right, I think we have time for one last question.
Hi, Mrs. Secretary. My name is Ben Allen, and I'm a civil engineering student. My question for you is, how do you balance condemnations with concessions and diplomacy with a controversial government such as Saudi Arabia? Thank you.
So I always begin with a deep understanding that no Secretary of State gets through their first day without recognizing it's a tough world out there. We don't appreciate how glorious it is to be here in the United States of America on a consistent enough basis and with enough fervor. Maybe you do here at Texas A&M, but I think too many Americans don't understand how blessed we are. There are many, many tough places out there. Having said that, not all tough places are the same. They each present a different set of challenges. It reminds me, you would know this, as a bit of an aside, but in terms of how you think about problem sets, when I was a cadet, what's the cadet motto at West Point? You will not lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate those who do. I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It was like, we had entire training courses. It reminds you of the glory of the American experiment. And so when you deal with these countries, you have to just recognize they're not all the same. Some of these difficult, nasty places want to partner with the United States and just haven't gotten to the right place yet, just haven't been able to move their own institutions. And some of them may only be trying half as much as they ought to be trying, but they're trying to move in the right direction. That presents a very different way of thinking about how the United States ought to address them. In those cases, we ought to assist them. We should never shy away from calling them out. We have to be consistent. The State Department puts out every year a human rights report. It's just a compendium of bad acts around the world during the last 12 months. It's way too long a book. But you should look at it. We call out friends. We call out adversaries. We call out everyone in between. But we have to find places where some of these countries that aren't living up to our human rights standards, we address it. We work to fix it. We hold them accountable as best we can. And then we work to make sure those things don't happen again. There are another set of bad actors who just as soon see you all perish from this planet. That calls out for a different American response. And so sorting those through, figuring out exactly the right mix of American tools, diplomatic tools, economic tools, political tools, military tools, figuring out precisely what the right mix is the task that we engage in at the State Department, but we do it with all of our partners in the national security apparatus as well. So the leadership in the White House, the Department of Defense, the intelligence community, the Department of Treasury, we were talking about sanctions, all of those have an important piece of figuring out what exactly the right mix is. So just two things. One, we need to constantly evaluate if we have that right with respect to every one of those actors. Have we got the right balance? Are they still in the same place? Are they still making progress? Are they still serious about addressing these shortcomings that we identify? And then second, we have to be relentless, whether they are friends or adversaries, and making sure when a nation falls short that America will never shy away from calling them out for that behavior that didn't rise to the level that we hope every nation can achieve.
All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have today. Thank you so much.
Thank you all very much.
Taking our questions. It's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
Thank you. It's great to meet you, too.